press a button when you see a politician.
Okay.
So there must be a task that cannot be performed without doing the categorization.
Right, they don't have to learn that rule, you tell it to them.
Right, now as you'll see in the guilty knowledge test, sometimes the rule can force itself on the subject. And then we get the P300 from a category. So if I'll show you a bunch of words and tell you have to memorize them, but some of them will be of a different category than the others, you'll get a P300 to a different category, even though I didn't tell you to make this. And that's crucial for the guilty knowledge test, and to many other things. But sometimes you tell them, if you really want to do it. And one category appears relatively infrequently. And if all this happens, you get a P300, which is what you see here. It's large at the back of the head. P is parietal, C is central, F is frontal, so it tends to be large at the back of the head. This is what's elicited by the frequent events. This is what's elicited by the rare category. Okay, so that's the P300. And it was discovered by Sam Sutton in 1965, and there's a huge literature on the P300. It tends to be very sensitive to the probability of events, so that if this is a sequence of oddball paradigms with different probabilities, and you can see that as the probability increases, the amplitude decreases on this side and increases on this side, so it's related to the problem. That's the kind of work you have to do to try to map how it reacts to the antecedent conditions. This is a study we published, in fact, one of the few studies available, that was explicitly concerned with the reliability of the P300. So we ran 40 subjects or so. And I don't know if you can see it, it's small to see, but each one of these is the result of an oddball paradigm. And I think it's easy to see that in virtually all cases, it's not an accident, but in virtually all cases we get a P300. And that they're different across subjects. As far as we're concerned, that variance is of no interest. It's never been of any interest to us because all the comparisons we make across subjects. So if you look at this, this is what I just showed you, and this is what happens when the subject has a different task. So there's attention is drawn away from the sequence. And you can see that in most subjects, the P300 disappears, but there are a few that persist and show exactly the same thing on this side as on that side. So there is quite a bit of individual variability, but it's basically quite a reliable phenomenon. And we have run by now, you know, over the 30-odd years I've been at Illinois, we must have run hundreds, you know, thousands of people, and basically anybody who plays the game according to the rules has a P300. Right now you're wasting a lot of P300s because nobody's studying. I'm sure you're getting.
We're recording.
and the oddballs in this case are what you're seeing.
So what do we know? We know that the amplitude is inversely proportional to probability. The amplitude depends on the centrality of the task to the subject. That's been established in a lot of work. It's sensitive to the time interval between successive occurrences of the event. The latency depends on the full processing of an event. And we also know that it's actually not necessary to the task you're performing. It has to do with managing. It's what I call the homunculus bureaucraticus. It deals with the management of the brain managing its own affairs rather than with the action system, or what people call the executive control system. So this is a theory. I won't take any time describing it, but this is a theory at the level that the kind of thing for which I want to spend my time is try to understand what are the processes in the brain that generates a P300 and what we can do about it. But this is a meeting about a decade. Oh, let me point one other thing out, which is, I think, should be taken into account. This is a study in which we were interested. It's part of a whole range of work I've been doing with my colleagues since the middle 80s, in which we're trying to predict from the amplitude of the P300 elicited by a given event, how likely you are to remember that event subsequently. So this is called the subsequent memory effect, and I won't take any time describing it, but basically we present a series of events, and some of them are deviant, and this is the well-known von Restorff effect, and the subjects tend to remember better the deviant event. We were interested in whether it makes a difference how you create a deviance, for reasons which we're not going to waste time discussing. Now, the interesting result is this, and I think there's a message here I want to get across. This is the memory data for the three different variances. This is the classical serial position curve for the control items. So you remember well things that appear at the beginning, you remember well things that appear at the end, and you remember the deviance. The interesting thing is that the performance of the subject at the level of performance was absolutely identical for all three ways of creating deviance. We couldn't find anything at the level of the performance that would differentiate between these three performances. On the other hand, it turns out that at the brain component level, completely different processes are involved in dealing with size deviation and in dealing with another kind of deviation that has to do with the frames. And in one case, we're dealing with the P300, where the better recalled items elicited, the subsequently recalled items elicited a larger P300 in their presentation as compared to the subsequently not recalled item. On the other hand, for this class of events, the action is in the frontal lobes. And has good reason why this happens. This is more a matter of working memory, and this is more a matter of shape and physical attributes of the recall. We don't have time to discuss the details. The point is that the ERPs can reveal differences in strategy and in underlying processing that do not appear in the behavior. That is, you can have a situation which the behavior is absolutely identical, but this way of looking at what the brain is doing actually reveals differences which are very real. And I want to give you a small part of...
Are those both P300s at different sites, or are they different times?
No. You take the individual trials for all the isolates, all the deviant words presented in a learning sequence, and you sort them depending on whether they were subsequently learned or subsequently forgotten. And then you do two different averages, one for the subsequently remembered and one for the subsequently forgotten. So it's the same P300.
No, but you've got two circles there. They're different, but I was asking whether they're both
P300s.
No.
This is the frontal slow wave.
That's slow.
Yeah, this is known as the frontal slow wave. Tends to be it's a recently studied phenomenon, even though we actually got this result way back in 85 when we first published the data. This kind of study, and it seems to be related to the load on working memory. That is, the amplitude of this slow wave depends on how much working memory is involved in the subsequent recall.
But, you know, if we turn this around, I think it presents a real challenge, because it says that stimuli, it looks like they're all deviant. And at the performance level, the effects are identical. But small variations in exactly how you made them deviant could have big difference in terms of where they show up on the
ERPs. Yeah, you're right. I mean, but the base, this is what drove the study in the beginning. We knew that the isolates, that the deviant words, I remember better than the controls, but not 100% of them get remembered. And we also knew that because they're deviant, they're going to produce a P300. And we asked, is there going to be any kind of relationship between the deviants that were recalled and the deviance that elicited Peter and are those two variances correlated?
Mm-hmm.
Should I? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm only now getting to the point. Let me go very quickly then. So the structure of an application for any given component, given the knowledge of given condition, given the knowledge of reliability, an application consists of a shell which allows the interpretation of the control variable. So I'll give you three examples of shells. So the shell concept is, I think it's important to distinguish, this came up in several discussions yesterday and before. We have to distinguish between the knowledge about the component, which is what I've been talking about up to now, and the meaning of the behavior of the component within the structure of the shell. Those are two different things. That is, the interpretation within the shell depends on what we know about the component. But the shell is an artificial structure that I create to serve the application. And so the meaning of how the component changes is going to depend on how clever I was in designing the shell and how appropriate the shell is, and some shells are better than others. And so, this is what I just said. So, you know, the shells have to be diagnostic, sensitive, reliable, and objective. I don't have time for that. And so we tried three shells, all based on the work, I'll mention briefly, three shells based on the Elbow paradigm. One was a lot of work we have done in the 70s, and it's continuing now, other people are working on that now, to use P300 as a way of assessing operator workload in complex person-machine systems. The second is a brain-computer interface, which is a system designed to make it possible for a completely paralyzed person to communicate with a computer. And then there was a concealed knowledge test. The important point I want to emphasize, all three of these, even though they're very different applications, are based essentially on the Oddball paradigm. And it's what we know about the Oddball paradigm that allows the design of these three applications. But as you'll see, they're very different. They have very different specifications. Because the timing is different, the individual subject variance, and the noise sensitivity. The nature of the application is very, very different in a brain-computer interface where speed is important if the person wants to communicate as fast as possible. But when a person is completely paralyzed and absolutely no other means of communication, 10 characters per minute will not get you hired as a secretary, but is a very, very good way of communicating if you're otherwise completely paralyzed. On the other hand, if you're trying to assess an operator workload in a flying F-16, you better be able to work in real time, online, with extremely high reliability, because the decisions you're making are extremely high cost. Our patient, when he or she communicates, turns out they're mostly he, can misspell. You know, we actually manage to communicate quite well without spelling perfectly. So tolerance of error is enormous in the BCI application, but tolerance of error is almost non-existent in an engineering psychology application. The concealed knowledge test, time is not an issue. You can keep testing, you can do it 6 times, 7 times, 100 trials, 700 trials, somebody's paying for that. You just take all the data you need until it's all over. So the specifications for the shell are tremendously different depending on the nature of the application, and that drives the process. So, in the work, somebody that's not showing the figures. So let me just briefly say, in the workload analysis, the nature of the shell is we're using the classical secondary task paradigm, which is widely used in engineering psychology for measuring the attentional demands of a primary task. The subject is assigned a primary task, you give them a secondary task, and their performance on the secondary task, concurrent with the primary task, is a measure of how demanding the primary task is. The nice thing about using P300 And the oddball paradigm is a secondary task. It doesn't require any performance on the subject's part. So no motor action is necessary. You can fly your plane and beeps and boops sound in your ear, and you don't have to do anything about them. And or sometimes you're supposed to just count them or whatever. And it turns out that the amplitude of the P-300 declines if the primary task demands are high. And there's a lot of data establishing that. So, let's see if this will work. The subject is looking at the screen here. This ever runs. No. What happens is you look at the screen.
There it is.
Oh. Okay, and you can see the rows and the columns are flashing once every 125 milliseconds. The subject is focusing attention on a character. And this happens to be an open paradigm in which 2 out of 12 stimuli are relevant because they contain the character you're trying to communicate, and the other 10 are not. And it turns out, well, the theory is if the two items produce a P300 and the other 10 do not, and the computer can detect the P300, you can tell what row and column are selected, and then tells you what the cell was. So it actually works. I think I'm so happy on the... okay. So it actually works. You can see here the P300 elicited in this is data that we, that was also work I've done with Farwell in the late 80s. If you do 40 trials, you get 100% correct. You can easily detect it, but of course that would require give you a character every minute and a half or so, and it's too fast. So we actually tried to assess using bootstrapping what is the best performance we can get, and it turns out in the original work we have done, we got 90% accuracy with an average of 10 trials, which gave us about 5 characters a minute. In more recent work that we've done, using better signal detection techniques and so forth, we were able now to get it up to 8 or 9 characters in that. It actually, I think, to some extent, an underestimate, and this also sort of illustrates the nature of the shed. All these numbers assume that you need perfect spelling, that each character is independent of all the other characters. You can actually build in all kinds of logic. Yeah. Well, it turns out we've tried several different rates. If we make it, this is 8 per second.
Yes,
if we make it, even there's an interaction between the number, you don't gain anything. If we make it any faster, we need more trial. The signal to noise ratio drops, so because they overlap. So we played with several different ratios, and it ends up that's about what it gives us. So the energy is going into developing different signal detection techniques. You can also use it as a menu instead of as characters, so that you reduce the amount of information communicated, but you can do it much faster. Now, the Shell for Concealed Knowledge, which has gotten a lot of press lately, is work we have done. And Farwell and I published in 1991. Subject categorization is inferred from P300. We had a hidden categorization. And one of the nice things about this procedure, this particular shell, is it does have a built-in control for countermeasures. The subject gets targets, frequency, and probes. So essentially, I'll tell you in a minute what it means, but let me just say that the technique is based on the fact that if you have concealed knowledge, the probes for you are different than the frequency and the targets. And when you classify them this way and you can't help it, you're going to get a P300. Now, the best countermeasure is to ignore the whole thing. All you have to do is just not play the game. And then you'll not get no P300. But if you'll do that, you'll also get no P300 to the target. So if you follow instructions and you pay attention to the sequence, you have to get a P300 to the target. And then if you don't get a P300 to the probes, that means you don't actually distinguish them from the frequency or from the target. That is, they're basically for you exactly like the frequency. So, absence of the targets indicates either that you're dead or you're not playing the game appropriately or you have no brain. So we assigned subject an espionage mission. The details of the mission were memorized. I don't want to take time. This is the... All subject gets 5 arbitrary phrases to which he has to respond, and they're embedded in a sequence of similar targets, and 70% are probes related to the espionage mission. So it's essentially just a regular oddball paradigm. For innocent subject, targets elicit a large P300, neither the frequency nor the probes elicit the P300. The subject has no information that makes the probe distinct. Guilty subject, the targets elicit the P300 because they do. The frequency do not elicit the P300, but the probes do elicit the P300 because the subject recognizes the probes as distinct items. That's the logic. And, for some reason this thing is not projecting the figures, but it actually worked. It worked quite well. We developed a bootstrapping technique for assessing the data. It's been in the field for 10 years. A couple of months ago, as you know, Larry Farwell got a lot of press applying this technique in a specific case in Iowa, and actually Bill and I had the honor of testifying in Council Bluffs, Iowa, on two sides of this case. I did not think that was could be admissible, and that's actually what the judge seems to agree. But the reason I'm bringing this up, I think it's an important point, because even Larry's data is shown on his website, and I've only seen his website data. This is the target, this is the alibi test. This is the data that according to Larry show that the subject in fact remembers the alibi items. So this is the target in red. The probes and the irrelevance appear together. The interesting part is that this data according to him, support his thesis, but what bothers me is that the targets do not produce a P300. And the whole logic of this test is that the target should produce a large P300. So this very data, if you understand the logic of this test, do not support the argument. But his actual conclusions are based on the bootstrapping of the two single trials, and I haven't seen that, so I don't know whether this is just an unfortunate figure that has been carelessly published, or there's something really funny going on. But this is the kind of logic you have to introduce. In 91 we said, this is a direct quote from the paper, it should be clear the study reporting represents but the first stage in the development of an interrogatory technique. Our purpose is to demonstrate it's possible, at least under laboratory conditions, to use earpiece in the detection of concealed information. This demonstration, if persuasive, should lead to further research that will examine the efficacy of the procedure under field condition. That work has never been done. And why that work has never been done is actually an interesting question for this panel. It's not why we didn't do this work, why nobody else did it. The question is, what is the process by which the agencies that are responsible for developing this kind of work do their scientific judgment? In my personal experience, actually echoes what Dr. Hunt said, it's not NSF, it's not NIH, it's not even DoD or DARPA. It's a whole different world. And the reason we're working 50 years with very poor science, very poor development, that's right to the bureaucratic nature of the administration of science and the agencies responsible for the development of polygraphy in any of its shapes or forms. And I think this is a worthy subject for investigation. I'll conclude on this note. Thank you. I have a few more slides, but I think this is my point.
Thank you.
Okay, great. I propose we break at this point for lunch. Lunch is being served in the main building, and we've lost some of lunch hour, and we'll begin again probably at 1:15. You can leave things here. What we will do is close the doors and put on the air conditioner to move us back to where we were earlier in the day, we hope, and then be able to have the doors open in the afternoon a bit as well.
Are we going to get that slide?
Yes, please. We're shifted. The schedule for this afternoon is going to be thanks to Sheila's last book, John Harris, followed by Steve Kosselin, who then has to leave to pick up his child back to Cambridge. And then what looked like the rest of the afternoon schedule, except for probably Tom.
Yeah. My name is John Harris. I'm with the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. And we've been doing some polygraph work there for about 10 years. The result of that work is a polygraph evaluation program known variously as PolyScore. We've had different versions over the year. Today I'm going to show you some results from that research, as well as some other things that you've expressed some interest in, as well as a snapshot in time of where we are on some of the screening issues. As a little bit of background, I'm going to talk about some specific issue testing. I'm going to show some validation results using both PolyScore as well as numerical scoring as taught by the Department of Defense Polygraph Institute, at least circa a few years ago. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the demographic covariates you've expressed some interest in, as well as some screening. Specific issue, just to orient you, is basically, did you do it? And for the most part, if you tell a lie in one place, you're lying to everything, although it's fuzzed up a bit with some of the other questions. So typically, a zone of comparison is the did you, do you know who, or so, for example. An MDQT has a little bit more variability, and it's what's called a single-issue, multiple-facet test. That's where there may be some good circumstantial evidence to suggest a person was involved, and they're trying to kind of ferret out what part of the crime they participated in, the planning, the execution, receiving the stolen goods, etc. These are interspersed with probable lie control comparison questions. Typically in the zone, there's one preceding each of the relevance. In the MDQT, it's usually a relevant control sequence. And then there's the Air Force MDQT, which sort of interleaves controls between all the relevance, brackets them all. There's also the buy zone, which is just the did you format.
Can you give a pretty quick example to some comparison questions? Is there a standard list?
There are lists published. There are various schools of thought on how to do those. Some polygraph examiners try to merge like with like.
If it's a theft, we will try to ask the person about prior experience stealing things. Part of the setting then might have to do with whether or not you've ever stolen anything of value. And, for example, maybe you're going to break at the grocery store, etc.
Let me frame Kevin's question differently.
Sure.
Maybe I'll answer what he's after and kind of help us. When you've done your tests on stuff like that, you really have it focused by organizing the data in groups where the questions in each group are the same? The kinds of questions are the same.
So your question is, do we have sort of a different algorithm for sex crimes versus theft?
Or the comparison questions that Kevin uses as opposed to the ones that I use.
Here's the answer.
It also helps me.
The first thing I'm going to talk about is our specific issue algorithm. I'm not going to go into the details. I'm just going to give a brief overview. It uses 22 features. The output, a single output indicating a probability of deception. It's a neural network with two hidden layers, 9 hidden nodes in the first, 3 in the second. It was trained using maximum likelihood error function and uses sigmoidal activation functions, which makes it a generalization of logistic regression.
And where did the 22 features come from?
Yeah. Where did they come from? The 22 features were got at by a process of sifting through the various feature sets that we've had, which I think you've seen described in some papers, building logistic regression models on those and extrapolating to, we held out 1/4 of the data and saw what kind of features produced the best models extrapolating.
Yeah.
Example of one feature would be the 80th percentile of the blood volume derivative. Great question. So percentiles capture the notion of how big for how long.
How many features did you explore before you put those 22? Or what's the universe for those 22?
Our feature space is fairly large. It's a number of probably 10,000. But I can give us, I'd rather not dwell on the algorithm. I have a different presentation on that, which I'll be happy to give if we have a little time. This will be more results oriented, and then we can come back to details. So this is the how well, not the how.
I think we need to know a lot of how.
Well, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that. Let me do the how. And we'll come back, or the how well, and we'll come back to that. Right? I mean, if you find an algorithm under your pillow and you see how well it works, that's how well it works. Now, for the specific issue test, basically we're neutral in terms of the base rate. We assume that there's a 50-50 chance of being deceptive for that subject, and that's achieved through weighting because our database isn't exactly the same for truthful and deceptives, right? We don't have the same number of cases in there. Well, I'm going to talk about the data in the next slide, I think. That's the next slide. The data came to us through the government. It's a variety of formats from a variety of agencies. Much of it's confirmed, some of it isn't. The ones that weren't confirmed were consensus scored by polygraph examiners. When I show validation results, it'll be against confirmed data only.
Are these screening tests or specific?
These are specific issue tests. We'll talk about the screening.
How many of these were confirmed and how many of these were consensus?
The ones that are green and red, those are confirmed, deceptive, and truthful. The ones that are, well, the colors didn't come out too well here. Orange and another shade of green, those were ones that were consensus scored.
And what do you mean by confirmation? I mean,
Confirmation is generally through confession, and I think it's fair to say that most of those would be confession.
And what's on that graph?
That graph once again shows the number of cases that were in various formats and whether or not they were confirmed, and if they were, whether they were, and whether they were truthful or deceptive.
There are other kinds of confirmation, though there are not.
Yes, but not a great deal of that. I mean, most cases get confirmed through confessions in some point. Either you get confirmed truthful because the other guy confessed, or you can confess.
Can I ask sort of the universe in which these 14,111 cases come from? Is that describable in some sense?
You mean overall, do they come from sort of are they a random kind of set of the federal polygraph exams? I think they are. Okay, from a variety of agencies.
Well, random set from among those.
Well, they're not strictly random.
Determination.
Excuse me?
You know, they are drawn from the universe for which there is some form of determination.
That's true.
Which may not be representative of what we're seeing.
That's true.
Did you, your neural net answers your interest on the basis of all 1,400 cases, say about part of them the best of your generalizability?
Yes and no. The features were selected, the initial 22 features were selected from a subset of the data. And they were selected based on their ability to extrapolate to a whole data set. Then the net itself is designed using cross-validation. So there's a training, and a training test set. And for the final net, I did train on everything. Okay. Once I had my process down, I was confident that I had everything the way I wanted it. I'm going to show you results, though, on a net that was not trained on a full set. And so we have some confirmed holdout cases. There's a specific reason for choosing the ones I chose, which I will get to. All right, and so as I mentioned, there's 360 confirmed cases. On this one, we're going to show some validation results for. So basically, our subset of that 1,411 I showed you a minute ago, they're all confirmed, and that's the breakdown on them. Once again, from a variety of agencies, and there are a variety of formats.
But features were selected from a subset of the cases on the basis of their ability to extrapolate to everything, including those 360 pulled out?
No. The features were selected. They were selected based on their ability to extrapolate to a true holdout set.
A true holdout.
Yeah.
But then once you have the features and you trained on a subset, those were the features that were able to extrapolate to the holdout sample.
Yes. Okay, but right. So be with the features have been shown to be useful for extrapolation.
And sort of following up with Dr. Iacono made this morning, most of the cases in this slide are people who had a deceptive result on the polygraph and who were proved to be deceptive?
No. That would probably fairly characterize the deceptives, although...
I'm sorry.
So not necessarily truthfuls. And I'll say that now. I think that... You know, truthfuls get confirmed independently of their particular polygraph. They could have had a very deceptive-looking polygraph and still be confirmed truthful by the confession of somebody else. And then we might also ask, well, there's some results I'm going to show in a minute, but it is not necessarily the case that it was a deceptive chart which produced a confession.
But it would
certainly help.
But it would often be the case.
But it would often be
that deceptive indicators during the course of an.
So what we're saying is that we probably have a fair sense of what our false positive rate is, but not maybe so good of what our false negative rate is.
Did you get any charts that were run deceptive, but later confirmed that they were innocent? So did they actually send you any charts that the ground truth was contrary to what the chart was scored?
I don't have the original hand scoring on this. I mean, it came to be as confirmed data. Here's a confirmed one, so I don't know what was evaluated at initially. What I can say is, having seen some of them, that I would suspect that there were instances where truthful people had very deceptive looking charts.
You could do that after the fact. So there are lots of people you could submit blind charts to.
Now here is the ROC curve for how that 1.5 point X extrapolated to those 360 cases. I want to comment concerning the AZ value, which is a measure of accuracy, but it's a measure of accuracy that's slightly different than maybe what we're going for in the polygraph paradigm. AZ is probably what we would think of as concordance, and so therefore it answers the question, I have two people there, and they've both taken a polygraph test, and I know for sure one's lying and one's telling the truth. The question is, can I identify which one is the liar? If you pick the one that has the larger probability of deception in our case, no matter where it is in that range and no matter how small the difference between the two, how often am I right?
Isn't that the same as the year end in the arms?
Yes, that is easy.
That's the same as the
area. Yes, I'm just elaborating on that because it's a little bit different problem than we have in polygraph. Usually we have a person and we want to know, is he lying or telling the truth? So it's the difference between a closed set problem and an open set problem.
Well, it happens that the A sub Z in a single sample test is equal to compared comparison test, but right? You measure either way. One's a sphere, two times other. This is not crucial.
All right.
Yeah, question, how long does it take you to calibrate this? I mean, often in statistics we do things where we hold out a portion of the data and then, use the rest of the data and predict on that and do that over and over again. Is it, the reason you don't do that is because it takes a long time for the procedure to calibrate it?
Well, I did do that when I was...
Well, okay. You're showing us data on three, I held out these 360 cases,
right.
and I did it. Often, people would do it on the whole set, by kind of spinning it around.
Right, through a cross-validation.
Right.
There's a reason for choosing those 360, and I'm going to show you why we chose those 360. The answer is yes, we could do a cross-validation, although when you get into nets, it's a little less clear as when you're doing things, say, with a logistic regression or some other purely linear discriminator.
Are those 95% valid?
Yes, they are.
Okay. You're going back to your database, you have 360 cases, 299 known deceptive.
Right.
When you put your scoring algorithm in place, well, what was the passing? What was the failing rate for those 360?
What's the cutoff going to be when we get a probability on?
No, I'm going to say if you had, I may be thinking about this wrong, but if you put these 360 cases through your algorithm, how many would fail? How many would fail according to your algorithm?
Oh, yeah. The reason for withholding these 360 is that these were cases that we had blind evaluated, independently evaluated, whatever you want to call it, by three very senior polygraph examiners. Each case was evaluated by two. There were principally two examiners involved, although a third did score a few of them. And these were experienced in the sense that they provide instruction to other examiners, they do quality control, etc. And they evaluate these charts using 7 position numerical scoring. Now I'm going to show the results for the deceptive set first.
Well, those were just. Do you have independent confirmation of truth on these ones, or were they just the ones that were evaluated by the polygraphers without necessarily having a confession or a...
These were all confessions, I would guess. I mean, there might be a few in there that got confirmed some other way.
This is about how to use this in the
same set that you did your... Same set I showed you the RC curve for. But here we're actually going to make decisions. And we're going to have three results.
Well, what, you're not going to show us an ROC curve for the ratings?
I didn't have their actual numerical scores. I had their decisions. Deceptive, truthful, and conclusive.
So here's a deceptive group, and I'm going to show you some numbers that add more than 100. But basically, there are two dimensions to polygraph. There's a sort of utility dimension different from the other utility we were talking about earlier, but that's basically in how many cases can you make a decision, and you'd like that to be as large as possible. And then you have the other axis, which is how accurate are you when you do make a decision. And so for the deceptive group, we did very well at extrapolating the group. I'm sorry, this is a numerical story. On the truthful set, the story is quite a bit different. Using seven position numerical scoring as taught, produced a lot of inconclusives, and then in cases where decisions were made, they weren't made correctly. Okay. How did our algorithm do on that same data? And the answer is that with respect to the deceptives, we were virtually, we were statistical dead heat in accuracy. The inclusive rate was significantly lower for us at 9% versus 10. And the confidence bounds at the bottom are with respect to accuracy. Correct.
Nothing match up case by case. Are the incorrects the same incorrects, or are they
different? You're not different sample size.
Well, they have so many incorrects, so if they're truthful, they'd be very different. The deceptives, I think they only have one, and they have three or four or something. So
was there one among your
three or
four?
I don't know.
Did you have one among your three or four?
I don't know.
Were there 10% inconclusive? How different? Were they the same cases that you found inconclusive or not? How much overlap was there?
Once again, I'm not
sure. Can you help me with the figure on the previous one, the numbers in parentheses were 525, 263, and now this one there is 267, 428. What is that?
Well, recall we had two people. Everything was evaluated twice here.
Okay.
But only once by our algorithm. Same set of data, two examples.
Sure.
Yeah.
On the right.
Yes.
So we're talking about 60-odd...
Not a large sample.
Right. We're talking about 60-odd sets of charts that were supplied to you as conclusively truthful based on either validation by confession or by clear agreement.